and welcome to the podcast show called What Do I Say? My name is Ryan. I'm a pastor here at New Hope Church, and I'm joined by Pastor Tom.
Hi, everybody.
We both want to thank you for listening wherever you might be today, whether at home or maybe in the car. Thank you for making us a part of your day. And this podcast exists to strive to apply the timeless truth of Scripture to the timely topics that we face today. And each episode, we take on an issue much like we will be doing here right now. And of course, as always, if you would like to interact with us about this topic or any other, we definitely welcome you to email either one of us or both of us. I'm at ryan@newhopeadel.org and Pastor Tom is at tom@newhopeadel.org. We would love to hear from you. Well, today we are introducing a rather lengthy podcast broken up into some smaller episodes where we're going to take on the topic of Islam, especially as it's related to current events taking place in the Middle East. Israel and Gaza, of course, has our attention right now. Neither of us make any claims to be experts in the topics that we'll be hitting today, but we do study and pay attention and hopefully have some things to offer.
I think you're going to like this.
We want to inform. We don't want to overwhelm, but we want to take the information that we share related to Islam and apply it again to the issues that we're seeing in the world today. So here's our plan. We want to take on a couple questions. The first one is, what is the story or background of Islam? In other words, how did it start? What's the narrative for how the whole religion began and where it is at today? Also talk about, with that, the primary beliefs of Islam. So our focus for this podcast is to take on both of those topics. Now, in the next podcast that we'll invite you to join us to, we're going to take that foundation then and apply it to a couple other questions. Namely, why is there terrorist activity happening in the world today? What's going on within Islam that in some cases will fuel this type of activity? And this is really to help us better understand the times. And then our final question is related to what is going on in Israel and Gaza right now.
And I think part of it is that we want to help you to see how all these things are connected together. And so the history, I think, is pretty interesting. Hang with us. If history is not your stuff, not your thing, then I think you'll find that there are some connections to right now, today.
Well, absolutely. And I hope that's the case, of course, along with Pastor Tom. And so let's jump in. Let's get going. First, just to give us some big picture sort of context, when it comes to the religion of Islam, we're talking about a whole lot of people in the world. It is the second largest religion in the world, approximately, give or take, 2 billion people. It is growing today. In fact, it's noted statistically that approximately 56% of the world is either self-identified as Christian or Muslim. Christianity still is the largest religion in the world, 2.4 billion people. We're talking about a lot of people, though, between the two.
Yeah, so you probably know this, but around, I think, 7.5 billion people in the world today. I know it's changing all the time. And I find that when I travel, both in Africa and in India, there's growth that's taking place in Islam. When I ask, like in an African country, what's going on spiritually, religiously, almost always they'll tell me, oh, there's new mosques that are coming and Islam is growing.
To that end, they're predicting in the year 2050 that 62.1% of the world will be either Muslim or Christian. Mm. So you're right. We're seeing that. Africa, Europe, various places. Large growth, lots of people. Well, let's take a step back from all of that, though. Let's go back many years ago to talk about the story or the beginning of Islam. As Pastor Tom mentioned, it's an interesting story. It began as a religion. It began in Arabia at the time that the Roman Empire was collapsing. And we know from history that when the Roman Empire collapsed, there was a power vacuum that really was set into place. And in that setting, the founder of Islam, Muhammad, which to give us some context, he was born in 570 AD and died in 632. He really was a man that history should know nothing about. In other words, here's his story as he started out in the world. His dad, Abdullah, died before he was born. His mom, Amina, died when Muhammad was only 6 years old. As a result, he went to live with and be raised by his grandfather. And for 2 years, that happened until the grandfather died. And then he was shuffled and moved to the home of his uncle, Abu Talib, who took him in. But history tells us that Abu generally ignored the boy and paid no attention to him. He grew up, and as he became of age to work, he took a couple jobs. He was a camel driver and a merchant, which we could say sort of might look like an Uber driver / taxi cab driver, and took some night shifts at Walmart. Nothing wrong with those jobs, but that's what he did. And he just kind of blended in to life in the city of Mecca. Now, Muhammad's life changed pretty dramatically when he was 25 years old. This is 595 AD. He met the love of his life and married Khadijah. And they, by all purposes, at least we could tell, they had a good marriage. Now, she was 40 years old when they got married. So there is a 15-year gap between those two. But the thing about Khadijah that is interesting is that first, she proposed to him. That was rather unique. But also, she was a widow and independently wealthy. So when they married, Muhammad stepped out of his jobs and focused on starting a family together. Now, in total, they had 4 daughters and 2 sons. But sadly, all but 2 daughters passed away. At the age of 40 is when we have the next significant event in Muhammad's life. We're now in the year 610 AD. It was said that Muhammad, who had lots of free time on his hands, was in a cave meditating. Some accounts say he was sleeping. Either way, he's in this cave in Mecca, and in that setting, it is reported that he had a vision. Now, in the vision, the angel Gabriel came to him, choked him, and gave him a new message. This new message are the first verses of the Quran. Now, this event really deeply bothered Muhammad. He didn't enjoy this experience. It wasn't something that he talked about in any favorable terms. In fact, he thought, and we learned this from one of the hadiths, he thought that he had a demon that had visited him. And as a result of this event in his life, again, when he was 40 years old, he entered into a 3-year bout with depression. He even got to a point where he was contemplating suicide. So fast forward 3 years. We're now in 613 AD. And Muhammad then reported that once again, the angel Gabriel appeared to him also, or again, and continued to reveal more of a new revelation. The one that started 3 years prior began to give him this new revelation. And Muhammad was told to write it down, which eventually became what we know today as the Quran. Now, what's interesting is, and what Muslims often point to, is that Muhammad was illiterate. He could neither read nor write. And so the fact that Muhammad would appear from the cave and have these writings that were given to him from the angel Gabriel for Muslims is considered a miraculous and verifying event. So what happens next? Well,
before we go on, so just thinking this through, either somebody wrote those down, I mean, he spoke to them and somebody else wrote them down, or he learned how to write Arabic somewhere along the line, just kind of from our perspective.
There got to be some explanation.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Muhammad has, he has this revelation. He's got these verses, to call them that, the Quran there. And so what does he do with it? Well, he goes to his wife first, and this seems reasonable. We would tell our spouse about things that are going on in our lives. And Khadijah does believe him. She is the first to believe that Muhammad is a prophet of God and really does support him in that endeavor. The small group began to grow. Muhammad's 10-year-old cousin, Ali Abin Abi Talib.
Wow, say that fast, that's a mouthful. 3 times.
Let's call him Ali.
Yeah.
And a close friend, Abu Bakr, both believed. This group of 4 really represented the beginnings of what we know to be Islam today. The 3 supporting Muhammad, they were behind him. and believed that this revelation that he had was worth sharing. And so with the group behind him and supporting him, he began in the streets of Mecca, Muhammad that is, to preach, to share his new ideas with the public. And the result was not, I think, what he hoped for. The Meccans largely ignored him. They mocked him. It gained very little traction over the next few years. The religion did grow. There were some people, mostly the social outcasts of the day, that were attracted for various reasons to this new movement and joined in, but nothing of substance, so to speak. And this group that was small, they also began to experience some substantial persecution. Some of the Muslims were killed in Mecca. These early group were forced to leave the community. It was not a pleasant early experience. Interestingly enough, it was the early Christians in that area that were the ones who were the most kind and supportive, not in the teachings of Islam, but in the compassion for the plight of what they were going through. These years of Elijah sharing the vision, 5 or 6 years or so, of beating the streets and talking to people, getting very little traction, were difficult years for Muhammad. But in the year 619, things turned from bad to worse. In 619, his wife, Khadijah, died. As a result, he went into a deep season of grief. And I think, personally, this is reasonable. I mean, if you think about it, he lost his parents at an extremely young age, a grandparent, 4 kids, now his wife. He's experiencing persecution. Things are not easy for him right now. It's also noted too, especially during these later years, that Muhammad had some degree of health problems too. One of the things that's pointed out is that he was likely epileptic. There are quotes that described how he would be thrown into seizures, like we might see today. Though, in light of the epilepsy that he seems to have experienced and dealt with, many felt that these types of convulsions were evidence of God speaking to or through the prophet. In the midst of these difficult times, fast forward one more year to AD 620, Muhammad had two experiences in the course of one evening that fundamentally for Muhammad and Islam changed things for good. Now, whether these actually happened or didn't happen, that's for people to discern and decide. I'll just mention this on the front end, there is debate even among Muslims about whether these two experiences that we'll describe here briefly were spiritual experiences or physical experiences. Nobody seems to know. Then again, there's interior debate inside Islam about it. But here they are. The first one is called the Isra. And the Isra is the event, Muslims would say, miraculous event, where the angel Gabriel again showed up to Muhammad as the prophet of God and took him from Mecca to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem on a winged horse. The account says that they landed on the Temple Mount, and where they landed is today the Al-Aqsa Temple, which is in a corner of the Temple Mount. So that's the first.
And if you go to Jerusalem and you take a tour, inevitably the tour guide will tell you about this as one of the events. And, you know, some of the tour guides like to integrate Islam and Christianity and whatever other history they can. And they just throw it out there as one of those kinds of things to think about.
The Isra, what we're talking about, is a reason why the Al-Aqsa Temple is one of the holy sites for Islam. The second event that took place that same evening, called the Mirai, was the event where Muhammad was given a tour of heaven and hell and was given the opportunity to speak with earlier prophets, such as Abraham, Moses, and they call Jesus also a prophet. In this event, Muhammad ascended to heaven from the Dome of the Rock location, and which, just to call that out, as we're talking about, and I know, Tom, you've been to the Temple Mount, so you can really speak to this. I have not personally, but that Dome of the Rock location is well, of course, the Dome of the Rock structure is there today, yeah. and that's why it's also a holy site, but is also the Temple Mount location,
yeah. right? Yeah, when they when you have a tour guide who knows kind of what's going on and is somewhat scholarly, which we had an actual professor from a Christian school took us, and there's a lot of calculations and a lot of study to point where the corner of the temple likely was at. And when you look at it, you look at the Dome of the Rock, you're saying, okay, the corner of the temple was here, but the Dome of the Rock had to be over the place where the temple originally would have stood, at least partially. And so it's a contested site, and you can feel the tension up there when you go up there.
Oh, I bet you can.
Yeah.
That is the most valuable piece of real estate in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people will die for that piece of land and all it represents. And you can go back. I mean, the Crusades, that was for Jerusalem. It was the Muslims took control, and the Catholic Church and the Pope would have none of that. And so you have events like the Crusades, and on it goes, these battles for who controls the Temple Mount, mm-hmm. and that spot that you were just describing.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing to stand there.
And it also has future eschatological implications, yes. too. So a lot there. And so again, these two experiences, the Isra, the Mirai, where Muhammad is in this location, has these visions, and again, pretty significant for Muslims that Muhammad had these experiences. 2 years later, from those two experiences, on July 16th, Muhammad, because his life was in danger due to the persecution he was facing, he moved with his followers from Mecca 200 miles to the north to a city called Medina. And the move was interesting in that he's setting up a new headquarters, if you will, there. And you would think that would sort of end the persecution. It didn't. See, after the move, the people of Mecca, the Meccans, they continued to pick a fight with this small band of Muslims who were now out of the city in this new location. Tensions ramped up, and finally it exploded. And there was a war between this band of early Muslims and the city of Mecca. And what appeared like it should be a rout of the Muslims because of size and equipment and all of that, actually, to everyone's surprise, the Muslims routed the Meccans. They fought well, and they, as a result, seized control. I mean, not only of Mecca, the city, they seized control of other surrounding areas. And there's almost a sense of, like, once you sort of taste blood, it's hard to stop. And so in the remaining years of Muhammad's life, two significant things happened. I mean, one is because Khadijah is gone, he's now, this religious movement is gaining power and influence, as well as real estate in terms of control in that way. Muhammad began to take many wives. He took 10 wives over the last decade or so of his life, in addition to two concubines, the most famous being Aisha, who was married to him at the age of 7. The warfare, though, continued. After conquering Mecca, Muhammad led his men to turn their focus on conquering the rest of Saudi Arabia. This is the beginnings of a term we're going to talk about later called jihad, holy war, believing that the conquest they were about was the will of Allah for them. And vast amount of land and cities and communities, they began to conquer these areas. These are bloody years. These are horrific accounts of fighting and death and conquering on behalf of the Muslim people. Now, Muhammad, for him personally, he got sick, and so his time of leading the warfare came to an end. He died at the age, as I mentioned before, of age 62. But he did get sick, and in the home and arms of Aisha, his wife, he died on June 8th, 632 in Medina. He was buried later in her home. So I think the thing that's important to notice, though, about the story of Islam as we begin to unpack this, is that notice that Islam began both as a religious movement and a military movement. It was both and. And I think for us to file that away as we continue to get into the beliefs as well as the current events that we see today with Islam, this is going to be an important piece to the puzzle. All right, well, let's move on and now talk about some primary beliefs for Islam. This is not exhaustive. Nobody want to listen to a podcast exhaustive of the of the beliefs of Islam, but really just want to hit the primary items here. So let's do that.
But I also do think that as we talk about some of the tenets of Islam, one of the things you can be reflecting on is how that compares with Christianity and what we hold to.
I love that. Yes, that's so good. So let's do this. Let's talk about five ideas, just five. Five primary beliefs. I think that's to be sufficient. Mm-hmm. And that'll really paint for us a good, healthy picture of what Islam believes, which informs, of course, how they live and what they do, their worldview. The first one, let's talk about this, Allah. This is God for them. This is ultimate reality for a Muslim, is Allah. Muslims are fiercely monotheistic, meaning they believe in one God. They believe that he is not only one, but he is unique. He is incomparable. He has no son and no partner. There is only one. And he alone is to be worshipped. I'm going to read from the Quran, chapter 112. Verses 1 through 4. This is how God in the Quran describes himself. He is God, the One, God to whom the creatures turn for their needs. He begets not, nor was he begotten, and there is none like him. So you have this picture of God that I would say he is, in this description for Muslims, he is very transcendent. He is distant. He is absolutely sovereign over everything. It is interesting. You talk about comparison to a biblical mm-hmm. narrative. There's no concept of Trinity. There's no son. There's none of that. No. There's one God.
In fact, they would accuse us of worshiping many gods. They just don't understand when we talk about three in one.
Yes. The other thing that's important to note here for Allah is that there is nothing about immanence. He's transcendent, but he's not immanent right. in the sense of relational, gracious, kind, loving, involved in the affairs of people in a way that we see in Christianity and, mm-hmm. and read in the scriptures. So this is the picture of God for them. I think that's the first thing to understand. The second is you need to go to their holy book or source, the Quran. Literally, that word means recitation, and Muslims fiercely hold the Quran is from God. It is God's word. It is to be, and it is, protected from any corruption or distortion. Muslims hold that the Quran is perfect, free from error, and the final revelation of God. Now, we were talking earlier, and you had an interesting observation, I thought, about the Quran in terms of the Arabic language.
Yes. So I have what is entitled a translation of the Quran, but a Muslim would never say it's the Quran, because the Quran, they think of, is in Arabic and Arabic only. That's and right. So most Muslims, from my experience and my observation, they don't usually read the Quran like we would read our Bibles.
So that's the second one. The third primary belief to help us understand is the concept of prophets. Now, this is essential. Muslims believe in the prophets. And you're going to find, I think, this interesting. They believe in the prophets starting with Adam. They also include and embrace as prophets Noah, Abraham, Ishmael, Moses, Jesus, as well as others from the Old Testament. So those figures are embraced and included in this paradigm that Muslims have. Now, Muhammad is universally considered by Muslims the last and the greatest prophet God ever sent to the world. Quran chapter 33, verse 40, as an example. says, Muhammad is not the father of any one of your men, but he is the messenger of God and the last of the prophets. Mm-hmm. So the prophet in this worldview, in Islam, the prophet with the highest standing is Muhammad. If you think of sort of the org chart pecking order, if you will, Muhammad is at the top. Now, number two in that order is Abraham. And you say, well, why Abraham? Well, because he's considered the exemplar human being, a prophet, a father of the Arab people. Now remember, Muslims consider Muhammad to be a direct descendant of Ishmael, who was their promised child. And so because Abraham's the father of Ishmael, Abraham is the father of the Muslim people.
Yeah, they just turned it around from what Scripture says.
So we see in Scripture, to your point, yeah, exactly, that Christians, or what the Bible teaches, is the view that the promise came from Abraham and Sarah to Isaac.
Yes.
Isaac is the promised child, not with Hagar, with Ishmael. Now, more on that later.
Yeah.
Now, next in honor or in pecking order after Abraham is Jesus. You might be interested to know that Jesus is mentioned 93 times in the Quran. So they believe he was historical, that he really lived and had a role, and he had a role as a prophet. Now, here's what's interesting. The Quran denies Jesus' death by crucifixion. They say, their official statement is that he swooned on the cross. They also deny his divine nature. Remember, God does not have a son. But they vigorously affirm the virgin birth of Jesus. Isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. Now, they do so not as a sign of Jesus' divinity, but Allah's sovereignty and power. They also affirm the teachings of Jesus, his healings, and his miracles as a prophet.
Yeah, they would even say that you can read some of the New Testament, but not the parts that talk about Jesus being crucified for sins and rising from the dead. Because their statement is, God would never do that to his prophet. Instead of just going to the source and thinking about it in terms of what the Bible says.
Let's go on to number four. Four, keep us moving here. So the fourth primary belief, and that is the five pillars of Islam. Now, what I mean by the five pillars are there are five obligatory practices that all Muslims are required to practice. Here they are. I'll move kind of quickly mm-hmm. through these. The first one has to do with testimony. In other words, the basic creed of Islam is to be repeated in every prayer, which is this statement, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. So a good and faithful Muslim will repeat that expression over and over in any given day. Next is prayer. Muslims are to pray five times each day in the direction facing Mecca. So wherever you're at in the world, five times a day, you are to stop what you're doing, bow in the direction of Mecca, and to pray. That's the second of the five pillars. Number three, Muslims believe in and practice giving of alms. This is to give financially to help the poor and the needy. And what is prescripted for this is 2.5% of a Muslim's annual income should be apportioned to and given to charity, or to give to help the poor and the needy. That's the third. The fourth is fasting. You probably hear this in the news from time to time, but Muslims fast from food and drink, among other things, from dawn to dusk during the month of Ramadan, which is in the summer. That's June. Typically, it's like first week of June to like the first week of July. So for that month, there is, for all Muslims, a time of fasting. And the final is what's called the Hajj. This is and refers to a pilgrimage that every able-bodied Muslim is asked to, should make, at least once in their lifetime. This is where you would go to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca, and you go, think of like a sort of like a gigantic like walk that all kinds of people go through, and they go to these different sort of places. For example, in the Hajj, is part of it is walking around the Kaaba, which Muslims believe was built as a place of worship by Abraham. That's that large sort of black square. And you see, I mean, just the number of people is incredible.
Oh, it's kind of scary.
Yeah, walking around there. You go to other places and you're to pick up rocks and throw them at the devil. There's sort of this symbolic scene with that there. So anyhow, you have this pilgrimage that Muslims are encouraged at least once in their life. You can do it more to participate. So those are the five pillars, these obligatory practices that Muslims are to do. Last one, number five, the last primary belief to mention here. And this will tie into where we're going to go to in our next podcast episode. And this has to do with death. How do Muslims interact with and deal with this idea of death? And here it gets a little interesting, because for a Muslim, after death, a person either goes to paradise or to hell. I want to call out one thing that is similar between Muslim theology and Christian theology, and that is that life continues after death. Both hold that there's more to the person than just the body, and that there's something about you and me and all of us listening that will continue beyond. But outside of that, there's not a whole lot of anything that's similar.
Yeah, one of the things you can see, both a continuation of some ideas from Judaism and Christianity and a separation from some ideas of Judaism and Christianity. And that's what helps to see kind of the context of where Islam came from.
So the big question is, where does a person go? Paradise? Sounds good. Hell? Not good. Like, so what determines that? Well, in Muslim theology, it is determined based on works. What you do. In other words, do you do the five pillars? Do you do them well? Are you faithful there? If you do enough good works, you go to paradise. But here's the kicker. You never know if you've done enough good works. Allah is completely sovereign in who he wants and wills to be in paradise. And so you think about it now for a Muslim. They're going through life and they're trying to be faithful in the practices of what they believe. But in there's always this nagging sense of, am I doing enough good to please Allah? In other words, does my good outweigh my bad? That's essentially the situation they're in. There is no such thing as assurance for salvation for a Muslim, except in three notable locations. There are three exceptions to this idea. There are only three places where a person, a Muslim, can have assurance that they can go to paradise, which ties into, and just to give you a little tease and hopefully invitation to come and listen to the next episode that we want to focus on, it absolutely ties into both what we're going to talk about in our next episode regarding terrorism today, as well as motivation and fuel for some of the current events that we are seeing in the world today. So again, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, and before we close out, one thing I do need to add, because Kathleen and I spent a summer doing outreach to Muslims, and like I said, I go to places where there's lots of Muslims. I would say that 99.9% of the peoples who are involved in Islam, it's like just they're in a fog. They're just ordinary people going about their ordinary day. And what we're going to be talking about coming up in terms of terrorism, the vast majority of Muslims don't even have opportunity to think about these kinds of things. But definitely tune in and we'll talk more about it.
Yep, we're going to talk about all of that for sure. It's going to be good. So again, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to the next time together.
Thanks.